Accession number 20308, Reel 1.
Sid Garrett, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
At Fulham in London.
Which year was this?
1916.
You grow up and have your schooling in Fulham?
Yes, most of it. The first school was the junior school, that was at Ackmar Road, which is no longer a school but now a housing estate. Then my parents moved to Roehampton and I went to Huntingfield Road School. At the age of 11 I was sent to what was then known as Fulham Central, now called Henry Compton School. And from there, I left there on the exact day of my 16th birthday and became an assistant to one of the most famous commercial artists this country's ever had, someone called McKnight Cowper, an American. I stayed with him and a printing firm called, Lund Humphreys, whose works were in Bradford, until the beginning of the war.
Why was this chap such a famous artist?
Well, he was a marvellous designer. And I learnt a lot being with him. Didn't realise at the time that I was learning so much. I was working for the great sum of 12 and sixpence a week. And I stayed with him, not because I realised I was learning a lot, but because I enjoyed doing the work.
What was his personality like?
Very quiet. He never swore. If he wanted to grumble, he would go. You knew then he was in a bad mood. When I got there in the mornings, and his flat was a top flat in Swan Court, Chelsea, just behind the town hall. When I got there in the mornings, my first job was to take the dog for a walk. And they had a silver can. I loved dogs, and I didn't mind that a bit. Whilst I was out, the maid would dust the studio. When I got back with the dog, he would be having a bath or whatever in the bathroom, and I would have to dust the studio. When he came out from his shower or his bath and gave me a job for the first job of the morning, he would dust the studio. You see how fastidious he was. If you moved a pencil, he knew you'd moved it and he'd put it back in the same place as it was the night before. And my wife used to say that, yes, he was temperamental, half-temper, half-mental.
What was his name?
McKnight Cowper. Edward McKnight Cowper. His real name was Cowper, but he found someone when he came from Great Falls in Montana. And someone realised he'd got potential how can you describe it, gave him money to go to Paris to study. He was there until the First World War, and then as soon as that looked like starting, he came to England on his way to America. But he liked it here in London so much he stayed until the Second World War, when I had to go into the forces and he came home, went home to America.
How do you spell Cowper?
K-A-U-F-F-E-R. McKnight, McKnight, and he had that McKnight added to his name because that was the name of the person who gave him the money to study. So his original name was Edward Cowper, but he put the other name in and became Edward McKnight Cowper. In other words, he used to sign quite a lot of his work Ema KK, although occasionally he forgot to do it and I had to write it down without his knowledge, so he thought he'd done it.
So it's McKnight hyphen Cowper?
No, three words, McKnight Cowper. Yeah, Edward McKnight Cowper.
Did you hear Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Yes, I was home with my parents on that day. And therefore I knew I was going to be called up. I volunteered for the Air Force, but they turned me down because they said, no, your age group will be called up soon.
How did you feel about the war declaration?
How did I
feel about the war declaration?
Well, I could see there was no way out of it. Quite honestly, it's a bit like the people we've got in Africa at the moment. They've got to put their foot down on it or else it will escalate.
Did the war affect you at first?
Well, okay, I suppose at that age, what was I, 21, 22, I can't remember the exact age I was. I was apprehensive, let's put it that way. My father had come through the First World War, and I knew lots of people were going to be killed, and I didn't want to be one of them. I've been fortunate, I'm still here now at the age of nearly 84.
So, when was it that you volunteered for the...
Well, the beginning of the war, and in the first few weeks.
Why did you do that?
Well, I look forward to going into the Air Force, to be honest. One has an adventure mentality at times. And I visualise being in aircraft. I went for an Air Force medical eventually, but I was turned down because of my eyesight and I wore glasses. I found out afterwards that was my first stroke of luck. They were looking for rear gunners who didn't last very long. So the interviewer at the Air Force interview said, you're a designer? I said, yes, I'm a commercial artist. He said, well, they're praying for people to join who can do camouflage, and you can do that. I'll send you to the army officer. And the army officer agreed. Camouflage would be absolutely ideal for me. Of course, I never got into camouflage. They sent me to Royal Artillery Signals, where I had to learn the Morse code. And although I learned the Morse code, and I can't do it now, I had difficulty reading the flashlight. I could understand the buzzer and send the buzzer. I could pick out the flag movements, the arms of the flag, but the little light, my eyesight wasn't good enough to pinpoint it quickly enough while I was there. I was up in Colchester. I soon became a member of the cricket team because I've been a very good cricketer. Had it not been for the war, I was going to be asked to attend a session at the Oval with a view to maybe joining as a junior. I used to go to the indoor cricket school run by Sandham and Studwick, the opening batter and the wicketkeeper of Surrey. They thought I got possibilities and wanted me to go when I was 16 originally, but my father said, no, you'll get a trade first. I realise now that he was right. And then they still wanted me to go after I was, well, as the war was approaching, but it didn't take place because the war intervened and I was too old when I came back to see that through.
What reaction did you have to the events on the continent with Dunkirk and so on?
I was at Colchester when Dunkirk took place, and you know, we had a sergeant who apologised to us that we weren't there. But we also had a lecture from an officer telling us how at one stage in the First World War, with the infantry in front of the artillery, and remember we were artillery, that the guns had to be pulled over the dead bodies of the infantry. That really intrigued me. I thought, well, I don't want to do that. Although we were doing signals up in Colchester, they also had gun drill. I think it was on 25 pounders or something. I don't remember the size of the gun, except that you had to push it around. And at a certain order from the sergeant, everybody would have to change positions. Now, I could foresee it was simple to do this on a diagram, so I drew a diagram for the sergeant, which explained it and made it much easier for the men to understand, and they printed it, and it became a regular thing in that unit. To you, Sir Alec, get down.
Carry on.
But the amazing thing was, I had to go for an interview. I wasn't too clear what it was all about. A sergeant was asking me all sorts of questions, and when I got to the bit where I told him I was captain of my cricket club's 3rd 11, oh, he thought that was wonderful. And within no time at all, because I'd been playing cricket for the regiment up there anyway, I was told to Brighton in a holding regiment with a view to getting a commission. I and a chap out of the other squad, a chap called Clark, Nobby Clark, had to go down to Brighton. Our papers never arrived. Never. They didn't know what to do with us. They hadn't got any indication we were going to turn up. I could have stayed home for a month or two and they wouldn't have known any difference. However, when the 4th Durham Survey Regiment was being made up to a full complement of about 800, the territorials were 150 short before they could go abroad, they just said, right, you and you, you know, you're off to High Wycombe and you'll now be in the survey regiment. They thought I was ideal because I was an artist and a designer. But of course, I had never seen a theodolite. I'm quite a good mathematician. I can still do quite a bit of good maths. But I'd never done logarithms. And there I was, supposedly, going to be a surveyor. I never achieved that, I can assure you. And there again, the annoying thing was, when we got to Colchester, Colonel Wetton had us, he was the colonel of the regiment, had us in the hall that was there on the very first morning after our arrival. And I can remember his exact words, because you are not my original Geordie regiment, my territorials, none of you will ever be promoted. And apart from one man, that is absolutely true. And that one man's father was a colonel and a grandfather who worked in the War Office, and they pulled the right strings. And he got his commission and came back to us. Now, I've been told since that had we been able to tell the authorities, he could have possibly been court-martialed for that, because you must remember that most of the people who I joined the regiment with, who came from Brighton with me in Civvy Street, were pre-war surveyors, architects, bar engineers. They knew survey backwards, but they weren't allowed to be promoted over the Geordies. Most of the Geordies were miners. Some of them knew a bit of survey, but not very much.
And he was the colonel of which unit?
4th Durham Survey Regiment, Royal Artillery. Colonel Wetton.
And he told you this at High Wycombe?
Yes.
What are your next memories?
Next memories are a week's embarkation leave. I got married to my girlfriend. And may I say that is a mistake for anybody to do, because you don't realise that most of your pay is had by your wife and you get very little when you're abroad. Anyway, we were on the boat in next to no time from Liverpool. We called in at Sierra Leone. We didn't go landed there. We just stayed in the harbour for a few days. And then we went down as far as Durban. Unfortunately, the man laying next to me in the on the ship had suspected meningitis. So we were all kept on board nearly all the 3 days that we were in the harbour. But we did get one day in the harbour at the end, on land at the end. Next thing we knew, we were going up the Red Sea and up the Suez Canal to, oh, I can't remember the names of the places. Anyway, we were then taken by train to Cairo, and from Cairo we went by lorries and whatever transport they could lay their hands on to a place called Beni Yusuf, just outside the pyramids. We spent a long time there training. What I can remember of that is one or two humorous things, in fact. We were still in battle dress, even though we'd got tropical kit with us. And I was doing a guard duty in this camp, and it was so hot, I was leaning on the post outside the guard hut. And I was asleep. I honestly was asleep, standing up, until somebody came down and said, Sergeant Major says, do you mind standing there with your eyes open? Which I thought was very good of him. Well, when you had any free time, you used to go into Cairo. And, well, I wasn't a drinking man, so I had to find things to do. And I found the Gezira Sporting Club, where it's a European organised, British organised, on an island in the middle of the Nile, where almost any sport was being taken place, from polo, tennis, squash, cricket, football, fencing, anything you wanted to take part in. So naturally I got involved in quite a few games of cricket. The canteen was run by, I can't remember, General, somebody's wife. And when she knew I wanted to play cricket, she sent me to see him, and he recommended me to get a few games. I found myself playing with Freddie Brown, the captain of Surrey. Bows of Yorkshire, people like that who were in the army out there with commissions, of course. And I had a fair old time there, enjoyed that, when I was off duty, when I wasn't on guard duty or whatever. How did I get on with the Egyptians? Well, same as most soldiers, I rather despised them because of their attitude of bargaining. You know, you couldn't buy a thing without you bargained. You knew damn well you could have it for half the price they were asking for if you got enough guts to see it out. I bought a watch. I went into a shop and bought a watch because I hadn't got a wristwatch. It only cost me £2.10. I thought it was wonderful. And do you know, that watch was still going when I got back here to England, though it had no strap on it, because when it was captured, I took the strap off and always held it in my hand when they searched me. Memories of Cairo. Well, the noise, the open-air cinemas, the click-clack of the backgammon in the cafes. I did a bit of painting there, although I'm afraid when I was captured I lost all those. Some of the mosques and places like that, when I had enough watercolours to be able to do the job.
Did the Egyptians take any interest in your painting?
Oh yes, I think most people do. If they don't paint themselves, they think you're very clever if you paint. I mean, I've got stacks of paintings here that I've done in the last few years. Everybody comes to look at them and say, aren't they good, aren't you clever? But they're not art critics. So I say, yes, thank you very much. I do enjoy doing it, and that's why I do it. I find it very relaxing, because it's not design work, because my commercial artwork was very restrictive. Any colour you like, as long as it's black, and this is how you draw the lines. Which was very often what the clients more or less said. They said you'd got a free hand, you had, until they decided what they wanted. And they didn't know what they wanted until they seen what you'd produced. Anyway, try and go back to Cairo. Well, there again I fell foul of the colonel, showing his vindictiveness. Because I was a good cricketer, the sports officer knew this. I used to referee all the football matches if there was a match, because I used to do refereeing here, and I used to play in any cricket that was available. And he came to me one day, the sports officer, Rodney Hill, and said, Garrett, he said, did you know there's a European college in Cairo? I said, no, sir, I don't. He said, well, would you like, they'd like someone to go down and help coach them at cricket. Would you do that job? I said, yes, I'd be pleased to. He said, but you'll need a special pass. It's in a part of Cairo called Shubra, and no soldier can go there unless he's got a pass signed by the colonel. And it's got to be a new pass every time you go. So he said, whenever you go, tell me in advance you're going, and I'll get your pass, which he did. And the colonel signed the pass every time. I used to go by tram into this part of Cairo, and I used to take the boys into the nets and teach them to bowl straight, bat straight, etc., etc., all the normal things one would do. Their sports teacher came to me and said, we've got a sports day next week. Would you like to come? Well, good, you know, meet all the parents and be nice and chat to people who are different to those with uniforms on. And I told my sports officer, he got me a pass. On the day of the sports day, I was put on guard duty. Now I thought, well, I can't go. So I'm told the sergeant of the guard, he made a request on my behalf to the officers, and the message came back, said, no, the colonel's had him put on guard duty so that he can't go, because he himself is going, and he cannot bear to think of a gunner being invited to the same function he's going to. Vindictive? Oh, yes. In the case of, I told you one man got promoted because of his father and his grandfather, Roger Hammock. And I've spoken to the people in the office since the war finished, the people who were in the office, The colonel knew that Roger had an interview to see whether he was suitable for office or material some 7 or 8 weeks before the date was due. No word was said to Roger or any other officer by the colonel until the day before, and he had Roger put on all-night guard duty at the marshalling yards in Cairo. Now, when you've been on guard duty all night, you want to shave, you feel dirty. Around about 7 o'clock in the morning, a Donar arrived, messaged Roger Hammock to go for his interview to the officers at GHQ, so-and-so, and so. He got an hour to get back to camp, shave, wash and change. The colonel had done it on purpose, I'm sure, to be sure, thinking he might therefore fail his interview. Fortunately, he didn't fail his interview, and his commission was coming up, and he eventually got it. Now, in the army, the same as in the police force, if a senior person gets promoted, if another rank gets promoted to an officer, never is he called back to the same regiment where he's got to mix with those people again. But the colonel got him back, and he didn't make life hell for him. He gave him all the nasty, dirty jobs to do. One little amusing thing about that, Roger had one of these little military moustaches, even as a gunner. And he came from a military family. They all lived around Salisbury. And I went for a shower. I didn't know what was going on. When I got back from the shower, the rest of the chaps were sitting on him in the tent, shaving off half his moustache. So, of course, the poor devil had to shave off the other before he left us. But he grew it back because I see him once a year down on Salisbury Plain. And as a matter of fact, I spoke to him 2 days ago. And although it's no longer trained, it's got a white bristly moustache now. He was a good bloke. He never took advantage of the fact that he was an officer over us. He was always friendly, always fair, always strict. The only time I've got anything to grumble about, on the very first morning, he was orderly officer, where he walked along the front of the ranks, looking at their faces, and then in the back, look at their haircuts. He got to me and I felt his cane poke up my backside. Yeah, but we've been friends, both as gunners and ever since. And it's nice to have a good friend, although he's been very ill at the moment, I understand, else he would have invited me down before now. I spoke to him, find out what was wrong. He's got a reoccurrence of his dysentery, which I had very badly at one time. I was down to 7 stone at one time.
What are your next memories?
Well, up and down the desert, what we call the Benghazi stakes, occasionally seeing the enemy, very rarely getting any sound ranging done because we were what they call a sound ranging battery.
What does that mean?
Well, you survey in microphones in the desert, 5 or 6 microphones, in a pit, in a thing like a dustbin, and a wire led back to the advance point where a chap was sitting with the button. Now, when the enemy fired, the enemy artillery, as soon as he heard it, he pressed the button. So that activated all the microphones. Now, they led by wire back to the HQ, wherever that might be, with a great big machine about 3 times the length of this table and about twice as high. And there was a strip of film running through with 5 or 6 white lines on it. When the sound hit one of the microphones, it would jog up and down. And of course it would hit the microphones at different times, if only seconds apart. But it enabled us as the technicians, or the technicians on the job, to tell our artillery exactly where those guns were. In the same way, when our artillery fired, they could tell them after a few minutes where their shells were landing. Now, this should have been backed up by a thing called a recorder. It was about the size of this table and as deep as this table, and it had great big rope handles, 6 either side. It took 12 men to move it. Now, I was trained on this. It was a backup for the electrical equipment. I could work out mathematically with the information they gave me whether they were correct or not. Now, this was fine if the weather was fine, but if you got a little bit of dirt in it, it didn't work. And this was the Middle East with sandstorms every hour or so. so it was never used. In the finish, they gave me a job looking after the rations. Even though I hadn't got a rank, I was in charge of getting the rations. And both the Nappy rations and the military mat rations. So I was really superfluous to requirements. What else now then? Oh yes, of course, we did go through the Greek and Crete campaign. We got up as far as Larissa, where they'd had an earthquake the day before and bombed by the Germans the next day, which is at the foothills of Mount Olympus. I remember, we were a number of us, about 30 of us, were sent down to the only railway station there. We knew we were going to retreat, and we were told to pack as many coils of barbed wire into the train in the siding as we would possibly get on before nightfall. And we were climbing up the side of these trucks, chucking these bars of barbed wire into the wagons, open wagons. And six Stukas came over, dive bombing the station. We had to take cover in slit trenches. The station was the other side of the railway line, and they hit it on a number of with a number of bombs. When they'd gone, we got up thinking, "Oh, we'd better finish the barbed wire," only to find they'd blown out the far side of the open wagons, and all our barbed wire that we'd been spending all day putting in was now laying on the ground the other side. And that was a waste of time. We're just about to leave, and some RAC fellas turned up in their trucks and said, the ration dump, if you want any bully beef or biscuits, then go and help yourselves. It's going up. We've set it to time at 9 o'clock tonight. It'll all get blown up. So we naturally, oh, yes, fine. Bully beef, M&V, biscuits, more than we'd ever had before, loaded them into our bits of transport and went back to pick up the rest of the regiment, not the rest of my part of the regiment, the sound ranging part. And as we're going out through Larissa, there's a red cap standing there. Oh, God, all this stuff on board, you know. They're gonna say we pinched it. He said, there's a Naffy stores up the road. If you want anything, go and get it now. Because it's got a bomb there. It'll go off sometime tonight. So we were going through Larissa, much to the joy of the local people, chucking out great crates of bully beef and biscuits and everything, making room for tins of peaches, chocolate biscuits, jars of rum. That's roughly what happened. We went back to the desert again afterwards anyway, but I didn't like travelling in the back of the three tunnels. I think there were three tunnels. It was so dirty and dusty in there because, although you were covered in, apart from the flap at the back, the dust and the sand used to get in. So I used to sit on the spare wheel behind the driver's cab and the framework of the, where they spread the tarpaulins over the top. And I became spotter for aircraft for the whole of the battery. And I was quite happy to do that. They knew if I waved, I'd seen aircraft, no matter whose it was. Mind you, there wasn't much of ours up there anyway. And they took the appropriate cover, if they could find cover. But in the desert, there isn't any cover. You're just on bumpy ground. And as for calling it a desert, that's a misnomer, because there's only about that much sand on part of it. The rest is just solid rock. And you bump it up and down like this all the way. And that's another thing. We went out there with hundreds and hundreds of cans to carry petrol and water. But they were made of material nearly as thin as this tablecloth. So you can imagine what the bumping did. We finished up with no water and no petrol, very often. Until we saw the jerry cans the Germans had, and we collected as many of those as we could and used those.
Any other memories from Greece?
Greece? Well, only that they threw flowers at us when we landed and stoned at us when we left. I remember while we were at Larissa, we'd put our tents up. We were only there a few days. And some of the boys, the drinking kind, went to the nearest village and they drank, I think they call it ouzou. It's distilled wine, very potent. And they came back drunk, singing, "If you want the Sergeant Major, we know where he is." They marched into his tent, pulled him out, and woke him up, shall we say. Fortunately, in those days, we had Sergeant Major Boss. Boss was a very good sergeant.